I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Carol Off joins me again. She's just published At a Loss for Words, Conversations in an Age of Rage, and it's already a bestseller. In the book, she looks at six words that have lost their meaning in recent years: freedom, democracy, truth, woke, choice, and taxes. These are words that have been distorted and weaponized to the point where their meaning today is often discounted or meant to be derogatory. These are words that were associated with civil rights and social justice, and she works through the book a way to reclaim them. Along the way, she looks at how so many people are falling for conspiracy theories, getting hoodwinked by autocrats and buying into the rage. And Carol noticed this as she was wrapping up her decade and a half as co-host of CBC Radio's As It Happens. She noticed in the conversation she was having with guests how polarized the conversations were getting. It's an engaging book, one that's informative, like when she talks about the Hungarian influence in politics outside of its country, like Canada, as well as how Facebook has been weaponized, using the Philippines as an example, as she shares conversations with Maria Ressa. Carol Off is an award-winning journalist who, before her over 15 years at As It Happens, covered Canadian and international affairs. Her first book, The Lion, the Fox, and the Eagle, was a bestseller and critically acclaimed. She's written three more award-winning books of narrative nonfiction, including her most recent, which she was on the program with in 2017, All We Leave Behind, A Reporter's Journey into the Lives of Others. This new book is published by Random House Canada. We spoke 3 weeks ago with Carol joining me from Toronto. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Carol Off. Ms. Off, good morning.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Good, good.
I was going to ask you what you've been doing since you've left the radio every day, but I guess you've been writing this book, haven't you?
I've been in a room chained to a desk for 2 years since I left CBC As It Happens, and I don't know why I decided to subject myself to that, except that I had to. I just had to write this book.
Yeah, and you write about this near the beginning of the book, that you noticed a change in the discourse. Guests increasingly angry, irrational, even accusatory. You know, I'm wondering what you think happened, and at the same time, is there somebody to blame or something that's happened in our culture that it's turned out this way, say?
Well, I think that there are a number of rage farmers out there, and in fact, the phrase the outrage industrial complex is used to describe this phenomenon of driving wedges between people, of turning us into adversaries, and it's the classic work of demagogues and populists, is to make us feel that it's us against them, that there's an enemy that we have to look out against, that the populist will take care of us, but there's this mysterious faceless enemy out there, and in our case in Canada, it's the elites, the globalists, the woke mindset, or whatever. And so there are people who played on that politically because they could gain from that. But it was also very much manipulated by social media and the big tech platforms, because they actually make money off of rage. They make money when people stay engaged on their platforms. And they don't stay engaged on their platforms on Twitter or Facebook when they're feeling rational and they're being informed by facts. They stay on longer if they are angry, if their emotions are being stirred, if they're feeling uncertainty, and those things will drive them deeper and deeper into YouTube and then into eventually QAnon. And so you have the phenomenon of people looking to exploit our differences, joined with tech platforms are making money from making us feel that we are enemies.
I was going to ask you, who to blame, but at the same time, the media has changed a great deal. I mean, a lot of people don't have newspaper subscriptions anymore. A lot of people aren't at the radio at 6:30 every night. So they rely more on social media. And I kept wondering, as I was reading the book, about if governments tried to regulate social media earlier on, or early on when they first came on the scene. Then I wondered, in this country especially, I don't think we would have had the appetite for that, would we?
I don't think they could have regulated the content, but I think they could have regulated the business model in this regard, that they're able to make money off of scraping information from us, right? So the longer we stay on, we keep connecting with other the posts, YouTubes, whatever we're reading, because what they do once they've got an algorithm, once they figured out what we want, they keep feeding us more of what we want. So that you end up being tied into the silo that your appetite is taking you into. And so they make more money from doing that. I think that if there were restrictions on the money they could make from the information they took from us, that the knowledge they have, these algorithms that allow them to figure out how to funnel us in different directions in order to sell advertising because that's how they make money, right? Is they sell advertising on these platforms. And so the more outrageous they are, the longer we stay, and the more money they make from the advertising, and then they scrape more data from our profiles. And so I think that had there been regulations on how they could make their money from us and our interests, then I think that's the business model that was the problem, not information. Because I'm very dedicated to free speech, mm-hmm. I don't think that should be regulated by law, but I think that the way they make money from us should be regulated by law.
And well, one of the cases that you show us in the book is Maria Ressa and Facebook's influence in the Philippines, which I just found fascinating to read about. You described it as weaponized social media. And she confronts Mark Zuckerberg in one episode, doesn't she?
Yeah. And, in fact, the Philippines was sort of the ground zero, the first case of seeing how politicians could make stuff up, could manipulate the media by creating the illusion that they had many followers and many people believed the material. So they do this sort of, they call it astroturfing, where they just hire a bunch of kids, whatever, and all they'll do is make up stories, put up false news, create Facebook pages, and then start getting followers or making up followers in order to create this illusion of momentum that everybody is knowing this, everybody's talking about this, when stuff that the politician in the case of the Philippines, mm-hmm. they're making it up, and they're doing it in order to further their agenda. And so the Philippines is the first time when we saw saw politicians using and manipulating people to the Facebook, in that case in particular, because 97% of Filipinos apparently get most of their news from Facebook, which is frightening.
Yeah.
We saw almost immediately in the American election how Hillary Clinton was attacked.
Yeah.
And we just kept on seeing this over and over again, how this was being used. And so now we sort of almost take it for granted that this is going to happen. But it really began in the Philippines.
Yeah. I was looking back at the book, and you do a marvelous job in the book about telling us the history of what's happened. And the sort of manipulation has always happened, I guess, and there are patterns throughout history. That's important because I think we forget a lot of this, don't we? About how we're manipulated, especially.
Well, and I think that when we go back to, I think that the last time it was very similar to this, where democracy was really threatened, was in the 1930s when fascist movements were growing around the world. It wasn't just in Italy and in Germany. That in the United States there were just millions of people who were supporting fascism, who liked the idea. And you had really quite extraordinary characters who had captured the magic of radio, who had millions of followers, like this guy Charles Coughlin, a priest.
He was a Canadian, right?
Yeah, Canadian from Hamilton, Ontario, who had millions of listeners, and his show was all full of the most anti-Semitic, vile, fascistic stuff, and people were following that really closely. So when we think of how social media is now influencing people with lies, the social media didn't invent this, and radio has a long tradition in being part of that. So, and that was had a great influence on people. People were saying, "Well, forget this democracy thing. We like that. We want a strong man. We want a Hitler type person who will run our country and make decisions, and then we won't be going through the horrors of what the Depression was producing." And so it's not the first time that we see, but we came out of that. People Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the president, and there were other leaders in other countries were able, to some extent, to overcome that message with one of hope, one of the idea that we can come together as societies and take care of each other. FDR was particularly successful at that, and that's really what the New Deal came out of. And the idea we should have a social safety net, we should take care of each other, we should take care of our citizens, and not let market forces determine that, and certainly not let fascists determine that. And so he was able to really turn the ship around in the 1930s because of that. And I think the same thing could happen now, is that people, I'm seeing this with Kamala Harris on stage in the United States, where she is offering the politics of hope and the politics of joy, and offering this idea that we can again rebuild our social safety net, we can take care of our citizens, we can be liberated from some of the worst excesses of these neoliberal market forces that have actually dominated our society, and start to return ourselves to a society that has health care and daycare and reproductive freedom and the freedom to be who you want to be and develop your life the way you want it to be developed.
Two of the more fascinating characters in the book that you talk about throughout the book are your mother and father. I want to start with your dad for just a sec. You write about his reading habits and what they were like as you were growing up throughout his life up to before his death. I found that fascinating because we know a lot of people like that, right? And the way they process or consume information, I think, is important to think about, especially today, what one would say consider truth or fact, and how that's changed itself, hasn't it?
Yeah. My father was not a discerning reader. He's like so many people, even though he had some post-secondary education, he didn't have a trained mind the way that I think increasingly people have now, where even my granddaughters in grade school actually have classes in being able to figure out what's true and what's not true. They're actually taught that in grade 4 and 5. And be able to determine, to be able to see through falsity. But there was very little of that in my father's generation, and I think in most generations. And so he read eclectically. He read what he picked up, and he was easily influenced by what he was reading because he didn't have the critical faculties to figure out, well, is this true or not? He trusted things. He trusted what he read. And so he was, and I think he could trust it because he was mostly reading independent media. He's reading the Winnipeg Free Press or the London Free Press when we were in London, or the Ottawa Citizen or whatever it was that he was reading at the time, and reading magazines and books, and he was getting a pretty reliable message. Why I wrote about my father and his reading habits is that what I would worry about him now if he were alive is that I think he would be vulnerable to the online sucking in of people, that the QAnon phenomenon. I think he would quickly end up becoming an algorithm that was being drawn and driven deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole into conspiracies. And he would have been vulnerable to that. I think, I don't know, maybe we could have helped him see through that. But we know so many people in our own lives who have succumbed to these conspiracy theories, who think that QAnon is telling the truth. And that was the most frightening during the time of COVID, when people believed the conspiracy theories that somehow that there was a microchip being inserted into their minds and they'd be controlled by Bill Gates, or that there were all these evil things that were happening, the deep state and woke mindsets, and these conspiracies all around them. I don't know if my father would have succumbed to that, but he would have definitely been the target of those conspiratorial sources.
Yeah, I guess that speaks to the state of the media because, you know, in your father's day, you know, when he was working, say, he would subscribe to newspapers. A lot of people don't do that anymore. A lot of people don't, you know, they go to their computer or Facebook for news and the sort. We can see how easy it is to succumb to all of that.
I'm really astonished at how many people think that they're getting the straight goods when they read the news on
yeah.
Facebook. I have journalist friends. I have people I think are really smart, and they'll say that they read a story. They say they got. I said, "Well, where did you read that?" "Well, it was on my phone."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, what? No, your phone is not a publisher. Your phone is you reflected in your algorithms giving you stuff. So you're getting a news feed, right?"
Yeah.
They say, "I guess." They said, "Well, that's not a news agency. That's Apple, or that's Google, or that's Facebook, or that's Elon Musk. You're not getting your reliable news source from that." But it can masquerade as that, and so many stories. If you go online and you look at the fake news, the phony stuff, which is being much of it manufactured and churned out of places in Macedonia, mm-hmm. or in one case, there's a major website that was part of the Freedom Convoy in Ottawa. It was coming out of some nail salon in Ho Chi Minh City, and it was just a way to make money because they knew how to manipulate people, and it's just a way to live at home and make some cash on the side by putting out false news. And it turns up in people's feeds, and they read it, and they don't know. They have
yeah.
no ability to discern between that. It looks exactly like everything else, that someone can publish the protocols of Zion, and it looks exactly like something the BBC might put out. And people can't tell the difference. And there's actually a really interesting Canadian government report, that said one of the greatest threats to our security right now, and they list 10 things that are a threat to our security, and they include things like war, climate change, but number one on their list is that Canadians cannot tell the difference between what is true and what is false.
Mm.
That is the number one danger to our security, according to a government study. Because if you can't tell the difference between what's true and false, you can't trust anything. You can't protect your society. This is what Hannah Arendt always said, that the purpose of the lies isn't to convince you of the lies. It's to break down your ability to understand what is true and what is false. And once you've done that, you're easily manipulated.
Yeah.
And that's what totalitarianism actually ultimately becomes, the manipulation of people, because they don't know who to trust. You break down trust. And so what the greatest fear I have with the people, not first of all, they will start reading this stuff and believe it's true until they find out that if they figured out they can't trust anything. They don't know if this is true. Is this article true or is this a false article? Is that a real person or a false person? And once they can't tell what is true and what is false, then they start to doubt. And
mm-hmm.
then they lose the trust they have in each other and in their society. And that's when they are most easily manipulated.
Yeah. And then the fear as well that could happen from that is it could disengage altogether.
Yes. This is what Vladimir Putin relies on in Russia.
Yeah. You write in one part of the book about the Hungarian influence on Canadian politics. What do you think we should be aware of in terms of what's happening in our country from that, say, sphere of influence?
I think that the Viktor Orban phenomenon, which is Hungary, he's a kind of a golden idol among the sort of demagogues of the world. And so people... mostly in the United States, people around the world, but in the United States mostly, and many people in Canada, go and spend time in Hungary to sort of learn from the master at how to manipulate people and how to, and not because they just want to manipulate for the sake of that, but they have agendas. They have political agendas, and they further those agendas. And so they think that one crucial thing for those with those agendas is to get rid of the media, to get rid of independent media. That's the first step for all populist demagogues is to have no source of independent information that people can turn to. Nobody challenging them, nobody doubting them, no one checking their facts. Because once you got rid of that, then you're able to say whatever you want to say, and you can reach people unfiltered in and just feed information directly into their lives, which is what we saw in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. But that's what Viktor Orban has mastered, and so many people go to study that, and they've learned the first thing you got to do is you got to get rid of the independent news, independent sources of information. You have to completely control the universities. You can't have independent thought coming out of the universities. You have to take over school systems because you can't have people learning how to tell the difference between truth and lies. You can't have people being able to have critical faculties. These things are dangerous for the demagogues and the wannabe autocrats. And so the first thing we got to do is break down those things. And that's what Viktor Orban did immediately. That was his first ambition, because he knew he couldn't become the autocrat he wanted to become in Hungary, which was once a vibrant democracy. He couldn't turn it into the autocracy, which he has now accomplished, if people had independent sources of information. So that's what people study, that people understand that. And that's the influence I worry the most that we are seeing in Canada, the possibility that the attacks on journalism, the attack on media, the words coming from the conservatives is that, you know, the lying media, or that all the journalists are working for Justin Trudeau, or they're part of the elite, or they're the gatekeepers, or they're the globalists, whatever ways and language they use in order to denigrate independent media is done deliberately to discredit it and to make people not trust any other source of information but themselves.
That's a frightening thing I was reading in the book about how much money, even reaches Canada from there.
Well, the United States especially has, there are just literally billions of dollars being spent by the richest people in the United States to break down our faith and trust in our societies and in our governments, because what those oligarchs want is to have an unregulated, untaxed environment. They want to be able to make money, and they want to be able to run their industries without any regulations, without any controls, without any unions, without any nosy reporters, without other government influences. And so they have literally put billions of dollars into the project of discrediting government, of turning us against our government, of turning us against our collective societies, our civil society, and to their own ends. But they've also joined forces with others who have other agendas, and that's in the United States, it's Christian, white Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. And so you've got these people who want to turn it into a white Christian nation, a theocratic government, or a theocratically controlled government. And so these two forces have come together in a really ugly way in the United States. I don't see that exactly happening in Canada. I don't think that Canadians would go for the sort of white Christian nationalist movement the way they are in the United States. And we certainly do not have the money in politics that they do, because we've made sure in our laws that it doesn't happen. Mm. But in the United States, it's just a dumpster fire.
Yeah. There is a chapter on the word woke, and I was just thinking as I was reading that we're at a place now that a lot of people, if they use that word in conversation or debate, that we automatically just discount whatever argument they're making. How do you think we talk to people who use that as a pejorative, as the pejorative that it's become?
Well, I write in the book that I want to reclaim the word woke for its own purpose. And woke was invented in the last century to really describe, it was just a word for black people in the United States to say, be woke, be aware of dangers to yourselves, always be conscious of what's out there, because there were so many people trying to kill them, right? There was just so many white supremacists and the KKK and all these groups that were out to get them. So it was always like, be woke was the expression. And then that woke became a word of Black Lives Matter. And it became, with the understanding of woke for that movement, was that there was far more political, and it was to describe how the racism wasn't just something that was kind of occurring in society, but that it was embedded. It was so much part of our system that it was systemic. And so the only way to get rid of it is to have programs that would reverse that. So that became then our understanding of what woke was. So that was turned back on people, back on the black community, to say that, oh, this woke mindset is Marxist. This woke mindset is trying to destroy America. This woke mindset is evil. And so they couldn't. What the using the word woke and wokeism, which is one of the phrases. There are racist, homophobic, Islamophobic things you can't say, because that's unacceptable. But you can accuse someone of being a woke radical or having a woke mindset or being part of the woke ideology, and that's a cover for what they're really trying to say, which is something quite pejorative. And so I see woke as something where you can smuggle odious ideas into the public space under the guise of wokeism when it's really racism and bigotry.
There is a chapter on the word choice, and that one I found quite moving because you talk in that chapter about your mother's experience, your own experience, say, going into adulthood, and then I was quite moved with the moments with your granddaughters, with your grandchildren. We see in one family, say, the progression of choice, but it's also quite tenuous, isn't it? And that's the warning that you give us with that chapter.
And that's the warning that when I went to see Margaret Atwood about it, that was her warning. The woman who wrote the book, basically, on where this could go in an extreme sense, and we think it was some sort of science fiction, but in fact, it was a cautionary tale about where this can go if women don't have reproductive rights and reproductive freedom. If you can't, my granddaughters were expressing their interest in being able to choose the timing and of children, of whether they wanted children, and that's something that my mother didn't have. And a right that I enjoyed, and my generation, women for the past decades have enjoyed, and then we see it now slipping away for the majority of women in the United States. And my own concern is that how fragile it is, just when you think that we are equal members of a society, that men and women are equal, and that we have the same equal opportunities to do things, which we fought for so hard, and yet that can be taken away because if you can't control whether you're going to have children or when you're going to have children, you don't have the same freedom that someone who doesn't have a uterus has.
I can't tell you how much I found the book so edifying and so necessary in our time. Carol, it's been a pleasure speaking with you again. Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Oh, thank you so much, Joseph. Take care.
The book is called At a Loss for Words, Conversations in an Age of Rage. It's already a bestseller from Random House Canada. Its author, Carol Off, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.